The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. It's nice to sit with you. And in our Buddhist tradition, there is a number of reflections, contemplations that our people are encouraged to do on a regular basis, sometimes on a daily basis. In the monastic world, this contemplation is done as part of the liturgy, where people will chant these themes, these ideas, every day. And as you chant them, you know, it kind of goes in and bounces off your ideas and thoughts and feelings, and it becomes part of your reflection, part of your environment to have be reminded of these things. And what I'd like to do is to read one of the common reflections and chants, and then talk about that a little bit. So it goes something like this. I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. I am the owner of my actions, the heir of my actions. I have actions as my origin, action as my relative, actions as my refuge. I will be the heir of whatever actions, good or bad, that I do. So those five reflections. And the closest I've come to doing this every day was I spent about a year every day imagining that this day was my last day to be alive. And how would I live this last day? And I found it fascinating to, in the morning, to reflect, you know, the evening, it's it. And what would I do? What was important for me to do? And over the year, my priorities shifted, or I looked at what was most important for me and kind of clarified a number of things for me. And it was a great reflection. It made me actually happy to do this reflection. It wasn't like this, you know, depressing thing to think about dying. I knew I wasn't probably not going to die. So that helped. But it was very meaningful for me to do. And there's something about this as a chant, as a reflection, which is just very matter-of-fact, very straightforward. There's no charge for or against these reflections. It says, just bring this up. So, I am subject to dying. I will not be exempt from dying. I mean, that's kind of basic. You know, you all kind of know that, right? And so, but how do you relate to this idea that you're going to die? Some people, there's a wide range. Some people are really frightened. Some people can't wait. I mean, I know people, just this week, someone told me about a 90-some-year-old relative who really feel like it's time, but, you know, the body keeps going. And some people are quite frightened. Some people, I know one relative of mine will refuse to talk, he's in his 80s, and refuses to talk about death whatsoever. No planning, no nothing, because, you know, I guess it doesn't happen. And so some people are horrified by this idea and come to IMC on a Sunday morning when you want to be inspired and nice weather. And we're going to talk about death and sickness and old age. I mean, this is like, oh no, I should have gone for a hike. So there's all these, you know, attitudes, but the way that this chant and this kind of is presented, it's very matter of fact. There's no charge. This is how it is, and many people find it very meaningful that in this Buddhist tradition, that some of the basic human conditions that we have are just kind of presented cleanly and directly. This is true. This is what's happening. You know, let's not avoid it. Be frightened of it, and let's kind of be with it. So, without any charge. But the tradition sometimes offers kind of a dichotomous or polarity between two different ways of seeing sickness, old age, and death. And one is the myth of the Buddha, what motivated him to go off and seek his awakening, his freedom. And it said that he saw the three or four divine messengers, heavenly messengers. And so when you're talking about heavenly messengers, divine, I mean, now we're talking about, you know, good, I'm glad I came to IMC. Divine, you know, it's like, you know, it's maybe inspiring, unless you're atheist. And then you worry. But the idea of something inspiring, divine, sublime, wonderful. So this is good news. And but then the divine messengers are, verse 3 are sickness, old age, and death. And here, they're looked at upon in a positive way, something that really has very important significance in terms of the Buddha's myth, being motivated to go forth and seek his awakening. And the part of the myth was he lived a very protected life. And so up until the time he was 29, believe it or not, according to the myth, he did not encounter someone who was sick, someone who was old, and someone who died. And so he went off into the foothills of the Himalayas, and there he encountered some dead person for the first time when he was 29. And that dead person was called a heavenly messenger because it was so important. One of the myths is that everything was done to protect him from seeing these things, but these gods came along and morphed into a dead person or a sick person just so he could see it. So it wasn't a really sick person dead, but it was just like a show. On the other hand, sickness, old age, and death is sometimes talked about in the tradition as the great adversaries, you know, the great challenges, sometimes in kind of stronger language, even the enemies that pull us down, that challenge us, that destroy us, the great destructive forces in our life. And sometimes they're said to be the workings of the Buddhist devil. There's kind of a person called the Mara, the god of temptation, that kind of uses the forces of greed, hate, and delusion to kind of, you know, want to keep people in that world. So you have this kind of, it's a range, you know, heavenly messengers, or, you know, to say it in more human terms, some people find that sickness, old age, death is hellish. And some people, maybe some of you, have hellish experiences with some of these things, old age, sickness. Maybe you've been close to dying and somehow are back, but it's been quite difficult. And other people find there's something sublime or very powerful. One of the most powerful, for me personally, meetings, kind of we call it interviews, one-on-one meetings with a practitioner that I do kind of pastoral counseling, was visiting a mother whose grown-up 20-year-old son had just died, and sitting with her and being with her. And there was something about time came to a stop sitting with her. And it was, I think both of us, it was quite a meaningful time. And it wasn't like the grief went away, but we were just completely right there in the present moment together. And the humanity and the liveness of that moment being there, and the stillness that we had, and the kind of intimacy we had in that kind of space, was certainly not hellish. You know, it was kind of in some way kind of sublime. It was kind of some of the experiences I've had in deep meditation have been just being fully there for that. So in this kind of range from hellish to divine comes this chant I have the nature of getting old. I am not exempt from this. I have the nature of getting sick. I'm not exempt from this. I have the nature of dying. Not exempt. It comes from a particular discourse of the Buddha and from the ancient world. And in this discourse, the Buddha says, for everyone, he says, specifically for men, for women, for lay people, and for monastics, these are good things to reflect on, to contemplate, these five, called the five reflections or the five contemplations. So it's kind of nice that he kind of presents this. This is universally good for everyone. And then he goes through and actually explains one reasons why it's useful to reflect on this. And he says that when you reflect on old age, that's going to be, you know, if you're lucky enough. I once had a conversation with Blanche Hartman, who's the used to be the abbess of Zen Center. She's in her 80s, mid-80s now, maybe. And you know how, you know, people get older, they start talking about their ailments. So, you know, I wasn't certainly not as old as her, but I don't know, about 4 or 5 years ago, I mentioned to her in passing, you know, an ailment that I had. And she said to me, she just kind of looked kind of very matter-of-fact, kind of lovingly, kind of as if she wasn't fazed at all. She said, if you're lucky enough to live long enough, this is what happens. If you're lucky enough to live that long, if you're you have the good fortune to live this is what happens. They kind of put a whole different slant on it, you know, as opposed to, oh no, I'm the only one this is happening to, and this is the end, and this is terrible. It's like, oh, of course. This kind of reflection kind of lends itself to a wonderful, of course, when you get sick, when you get old, when you're dying, of course. So what the Buddha said is that when you reflect on that you're going to get old, it helps people overcome the intoxication with youth. And not that any of you are intoxicated with youth. But there are a lot of attitudes we have about youth, about the importance of being young. We have a whole, you know, industry, huge industry, billions-dollar industry to keep people young, and advertisements and popular culture that really holds up youth in a big way. And some people, you know, are horrified when they look in the mirror the first time and there's a wrinkle. And this is the end. Downhill from here. And so this intoxication with youth and being young sometimes, or the fear of becoming old and all the associations we have to have with it. You know, no one's going to love me anymore if I have too many wrinkles, something. And the reflection with sickness, that I'm going to be sick, is said to be overcome the intoxication with health. And so you can reflect, I don't know exactly what the Buddha meant by intoxication with health, but you can imagine that sometimes people don't realize how attached they are to being healthy until they become unhealthy. How important their self-identity has been around being young, or their self-identity has been created around being healthy and fit and be able to do a lot of things. And not a few people have an accident or something happens, and it's devastating for their self-identity, their place in the world, how other people see them. And they get very depressed, very upsetting. And I've known people who've gone through that and come out the other end and said, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I had no idea how I was caught up in, you know, maybe intoxicated in the idea of my health and activity and my identity. And there's something that I had to let go of that was so deep in me that I feel so much freer now and lighter. It's a drag that's had to happen. I wish it didn't happen. But there's freedom now that I didn't have before because I had to face this. I have one relative who went through this and went through very, very similar thing, but her condition's been chronic for decades. And she said, this was great, but enough is enough. You know, this is long enough now. I got the lesson. But and then the third one, being aware that you're going to die, I suppose overcomes the intoxication with life. And certainly there can be a very strong attachment to life and being alive. And, you know, I don't want anyone to die. And I don't want to die. but it can be the attachment to it can be excessive. And my introduction to Buddhism, my first kind of inkling that I wanted to do Buddhist practice was when I was about 19 or 20, and I was aware that I was afraid to die. And I felt this. I felt like I couldn't really live the life, live the values I wanted to live, unless I kind of somehow faced and overcame this fear of dying. And so I looked around, and somehow I had a sense that the only place I knew at that time that would address this in some psychological or deep way was Buddhism, Buddhist practice. And that was kind of my first. It didn't get me practicing yet, but you know, I was 19. But that was first when I first started studying and looking into it. And it took a couple of years before I started practicing regularly. So we sit in the middle of our life is a kind of a metaphor for what Buddhist practice is about. You know, this idea of meditation is so central to our tradition. And the idea of meditation is supposed to be like the chant, like this reflect, the five contemplations, just a matter-of-fact way of meeting our life as it actually is. It's not meant to kind of look at our life as being divine and not meant to look at our life as being hellish, but rather to just be sit in the middle of it as it actually is. If it's pleasant and wonderful, to sit in the middle. If it's difficult, to sit in the middle. And this idea of sitting in the middle of our life as it is one of the learning to do that through is one of the great things that meditation can do for us. And I want to talk a little bit about how that works. The one of the ways that simple things about sitting down to meditate is not to be too, not to do too much when you meditate, not to have a big idea of what you're supposed to do and accomplish and get someplace like really concentrated, but rather to sit quietly and watch what goes on. Sit quietly, just be with what is. And that simply being with what is and watching is very different than how most people live their lives, where, so for example, if I am caught up in anything at all, say I'm thinking about worrying about my health. You know, I'm anxious that, you know, my health is fine now, but is it going to be fine in 5 years from now? And will the people around me support me? Will I be left alone? There could be real concerns and real issues that people have to think about. It's not necessarily neurotic to think about your health, but some people have huge challenges and even anticipating what's going to come. But those thoughts come up. And in ordinary life, it's very easy to be swept up in those thoughts and be identified with those thoughts and kind of react to those thoughts. And the imagination kicks in. You think about, well, in 5 years, what is going to happen to me? And we swirl and spin, and then emotions arise in response to that. Fear and anger and discouragement, and many things arise. And it's kind of just a swirl of activity that goes on, and we're involved and participating in it. When you are sitting and just being and watching, sooner or later, you begin to just see it. Oh, I'm thinking about this a lot. Boy, am I thinking a lot. And that begins a step away of becoming freer. And then you start seeing, well, maybe we don't identify so strongly with it. And then you see, you know, I'm very much in my imagination around my health. I'm anticipating what's going to happen in a few years. I'm going to anticipate this and that. I once, some years ago, got a call from my doctor, and she said, oh, we got the results back, and I think you have cancer. So I thought that was interesting. And it was even more interesting, I was in a toy store. you know, the cell phones, right? I picked up the cell phone. It's your doctor, yes, what? The test results came back, and, you know, it looks like you have cancer. The tumor markers are really high. And I said, oh. So I got pretty interested. And I thought, oh, this is great, I thought. But I was actually kind of not troubled because, oh, now I finally get to find out if all these years of Buddhist practice has made a difference. You know, 19, I was interested, right? So then, 35 years later or something, so what? So I was actually more interested than worried. Let's see what happens now. So to sit there and sit in meditation and watch the thought arise about the imaginary future and say, oh, that's the imagination. I'm imagining a future. And based on that imagination, look at that, there's fear that's arising. And start seeing it clearly for what it is. Oh, it's an imagination and it's a fear around an imaginary world. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? Like, who knows? The doctor called me up. It turned out I didn't have cancer at all. Later she called the oncologist and she said, no, nothing going on. It's very strange, right? So you can imagine when a doctor calls, the imagination kicks in, right? I didn't do it, but I could imagine writing a whole novel about what was now in store for me. Just that one phone call, but I kind of... So you sit in the middle and we see how this operates. And the magic, the specialness of meditation is when we begin to not identify with our thoughts so much, not identify with the feelings. And we just start seeing it, letting it be. And we start kind of letting it be, and just there, we see it clearly for what it is. Oh, just an imagination, it's just a thought, it's just a judgment. It's just a fear. It's just anger. It's just despair, different things. And it's to start becoming a little bit separate from it, and letting it be instead of participating in it. And as that ability becomes stronger, and that's what I mean by sitting in the middle of our life, and just sitting there until we start seeing clearly for what's happening. And as that becomes stronger and stronger, that ability to sit in the middle of it and allow our life to unfold, the thoughts, the feelings, the emotions, but without participating, without getting caught in the thoughts, the ideas, the feelings that are connected to it, then a sense of inner stability and peace begins to become stronger. And we start identifying more with that inner stability and peace than we identify with the thoughts and ideas and the feelings we have. And we're not condemning the feelings and thoughts. We're not trying to necessarily push them away. But we're just seeing more and more clearly, oh, this is what it is. This is what it is. And some of our thoughts might even be true thoughts. Someone might be treating us very poorly, and we see that, and we feel angry because of it. But we see the anger as the anger, and because even though it might be justified to be angry, we don't participate in the anger. We just, just anger is floating up there. Let it just be anger there, and I'm not the angry one. There is anger in the scene, because we've learned to step back and to see it, just to be in the middle of all this. This is a powerful thing to do. Many years ago, I did a weekend workshop, on death and dying. And I did an exercise with people based on my kind of what I'd done, my year of thinking about that was the last day. And I said, kind of had them all meditate and get calm and quiet. And then I said, now reflect. If you only have one more week to live, how would you live this last week? What would you do? So I had that silence, let them reflect on that for a while. And then now, you imagine you only have a day left. What would you do? Who would you talk to? Or what kind of things would you do with your last day to be alive? And now, let go of that, and now let's reflect, you have 3 hours left. What would you do? 3 hours left. And then I said, now imagine you have 1 hour. And now imagine you have 10 minutes. 10 minutes. If you have 10 minutes alive, to be alive, you're probably not going to be concerned anymore about your promotion at work. So all kinds of thoughts and ideas. I need to get my oil changed in my car. I haven't made the appointment at the dentist for a while. certain things begin to fall away. And then 1 minute. Now what happens if it's just really a poignancy of just one more minute to be alive? What's that like? What happens there? Now, if you carry with you all your thoughts and feelings and imaginations and everything, then you can be swirling and churning and lost in that. But if you have the ability to let go of your dental appointments, oil changes, and you know all the many things, and just kind of be there for the last minute, what happens? And then the last exercise was, what would you do if you if this was the last moment, the last breath? What then? It was a very powerful experience with people doing it. One person a year later told me, after that exercise, I went back to work and resigned. And I said, oh no. What have I done? But this was probably almost 20 years ago, and I've known her ever since, and that was the best thing that ever happened to me. I mean, she was maybe 60 then, so she retired. But that was the best thing. But there was another woman who did that, was doing the workshop. At the end, I asked people, how was it for you? And she said, I live about an hour away from the retreat center. And when I had, a week, a day, 3 hours left, what I would do is I'd go home and clean my apartment. But when it was less than an hour, I couldn't go home anymore. It was too far. So then I was really there. Then I was really present in a way that I hadn't been present before in my life. So this, so to learn to let go of many of our concerns, some of them petty, some of them very serious. And then perhaps, as it was for me, sitting with a mother whose son had died, there's something about letting go in the timeless peace that can happen. The liberation and freedom can happen there. So we sit. The idea in meditation is to sit in the middle of our lives and learn not to be reactive to our lives and to what is. To step back and to see clearly what the mind, the heart is doing, what goes on in our bodies and minds, and to kind of let it be. And in that letting be, to not be pulled into it or reacting to it, participating in the thoughts, participating in the feelings, but to step back. And then at some point we see some of these things are so unnecessary, some of the things we think about, that in seeing is unnecessary to learn to let go of them, to learn to not think, not just simply have some distance from it, but to let go. And so in that space, any intoxication we have, any way we're caught up in our life, in our youth, in our health, in life itself, is not so interesting anymore. There's something much more interesting to going on. What's interesting to go on is the capacity for deep abiding sense of peace or well-being or ease or freedom or joy and happiness, whatever it might be for you, that comes from a mind which is not caught up by the conditions of the world. And this reflection on sickness, old age, and death is a very, it makes this whole thing very real, very important. We're talking about central issues in our lives. We're not talking about stress reduction. We're not talking about, I think I'll let go of mascara. No, oh, not that. No. Sorry. I don't want to be too challenging here today. Nothing wrong with mascara. But to be intoxicated with it, I hope that meditation helps with that. When I was practicing at the San Francisco Zen Center, you know, kind of a monastic ethos there. And so people, could, you know, the idea was no makeup, no nothing, just very plain. And this Zen teacher, wonderful Zen teacher, Maureen Stewart Roshi from Boston, came to teach there one day, one week, and she wore makeup. And many of the women at Zen Center felt liberated. Wow, it's okay to wear makeup? A Zen teacher? So, you know, it's possible to get attached, you know, in all kind, every possible way, right? So, to develop and strengthen the capacity to meditate, to be present and not caught by what goes on, then when we're up against sickness, old age, and death, when we're up against some of the great challenges of our life, and there's many more than that, but great challenges of our lives, then we have the mental capacity to sit in the middle of it and stay calm or keep our ease, not get swept away by the anxiety, concerns, anger, fears that might be connected to it. Quite something. Yesterday I saw Selma. And, you know, I've met people who were in the civil rights movement. And, I don't know exactly how they were in their hearts and minds. But to be able to keep your balance and your non-reactivity in the face of that kind of hate, in the face of that kind of violence, takes a very strong capacity. And so how do you develop that capacity? How do you kind of live in the middle of your life? Who knows what you're going to be asked to face? Who knows what you're going to be asked to be engaged? You know, I don't think Martin Luther the King saw it coming when he was 20 years old, what he was going to be asked to do. When he was 24, I think, is when he was asked to lead the part of the civil rights movement in the South. And that grew from there, his leadership. But who knows what you're going to have to deal with in your family, with yourself, with the world around you? Who knows? And so to sit and meditate and practice is to learn how to sit in the middle. Not to overemphasize the divine, not to overemphasize the hellish, but to learn to sit in the middle of whatever it is that you're given that day for that time. And learn how to just let it be. And if when you come to your deathbed, how much do you let go of? How much do you then have the capacity to just be there and not deny it and not run away from it, not run around, but just to be? I knew one man who spent a year being anxious. He was a lifetime being an anxious person. One of the things he was most anxious about was dying of cancer. And when he got cancer and was dying, he finally stopped being anxious. It was remarkable to be around him. And it's quite remarkable to be around some individuals who, when they're dying, have just learned to let go deeply, and they're just there in a very simple way. Or I've been around people who've been horribly sick, but they're just there. And it's just quite inspiring to see what the courage, the strength, the ability just to be there and not be swept up in the meaning and the associations and the reactivity to pain, all kinds of things. So this reflection goes on, not just sickness, old age, and death, but also then reflection on you'll be separated from everything that you love. Sooner or later, when you die, that's what happens. And when they die, that's what happens. And then the last one has to do with really understanding that your actions count. You're the heir to your actions. The actions are your source. The actions are, are your refuge. That start kind of understanding that the choices you make and how you act are a major consequence in this whole ability to address our peace, our ease in this life. And so this ability to stop and meditate and really be still, non-reactive, not caught up, not participating in anything, it is very powerful because it shows us more and more the places of choice. we can choose what thoughts to get involved in, what actions to get involved in, what things to say and not say. And we can see that in the place of choice, in the middle of choice, we can rest. If we can see the place of choice in our actions, it's possible to rest in that place of choice as opposed to automatically and continuously acting and speaking and doing. And to find the place of rest in the middle of the life is a great thing. And then your choices can be much wiser. So the final thing I'd like to say about this sutta, this discourse of the Buddha that these five reflections come from, the first half of it talks about, as I did now, about these five reflections having to do with you. It's in first person. I have the nature of becoming old. I'm not exempt from it. Then the second half of it says, it's also useful to reflect that this is true for other people too. Others have the same nature. And I think that to begin to appreciate and see other people this way, it changes our hearts to them. I think it opens our hearts to them. We understand they also are dealing with sickness, old age, and death. They will, sooner or later, they are, just like you. And the idea of seeing others as yourself and others is a place of empathy, the beginning of empathy, of care, and all this. And to see it in this very basic way, of sickness, old age, and death, of being separated from what you love, that's what human beings have in common. We have differences and we have similarities. But these existential similarities we have can be the foundation for having care and love and generosity to the people around us. And to care for them, to understand their struggles as well. And then, with that similarity, to appreciate their differences. And then to open to them in a way that's respectful and caring. It was quite something, you know, this last week, thinking a lot about Martin Luther King. And I was reading about him more, and then I went to see the movie yesterday. And some of the movie was awful to watch. I don't know if some of you saw it. But one of the reflections was, they showed people, white people, expressing hate towards the people protesting and things. But I also looked, earlier in the week, I looked at film footage and photographs of those times, and they also had photographs and film footage of white hate. And the movie made it pretty, made it nice. Because the faces I saw in the photographs from the 60s in the movies was so intense. I don't know, the actors didn't do a good enough job on the movie. Maybe they didn't want it to do it, make it really real. The level of hate that people are capable of is phenomenal. Some people have to live with this. And so to sit in the middle of all this, learn how to sit in the middle, to sit quietly and be with ourselves in the middle of sickness, age, old age, and death, and to have a heart open up to others as well, see them in their sickness, old age, and death, see them and how they have to part from their self. One of the most moving parts of the movie for me was actually a particular character who was a real character whose, I think it was his grandson, had been shot and killed by a trooper in front of him. And he was an old man, he was an 82-year-old man. And the way he acted, the grief, he presented the grief, and it was so real. That was real. What do we do to each other? And do we feel the others and how difficult and challenging life is? And can we sit in the middle of that with a heart that's relaxed and open, that's calm, that's at easeful, and take it in, understand it deeply, so that we can respond wisely and courageously to what this world will need of us? Because I suspect that sooner or later, and I think it's sooner, our world needs us to be more courageous. And the world needs us to change, needs things to change. So this sitting in the middle and reflecting on sickness, old age, and death, and yourself and others, and learning to have ease with that, and learn to free ourselves from all the swirl of thoughts and the activity, just be here, I think becomes a great gift we can give to others and to the world. So the five reflections, maybe for 1 week, 1 year, one lifetime, you might make this a theme for your days. Just come back. It's the nature to be old. Just those first three, that's all you can remember. Nature to be old, to get sick, and to die. Without any charge, just recognize that and see what happens. Thank you very much.